Yeah.
You know, Parshas Chukas is very, very interesting for many reasons. But one of the reasons is that it literally jumps over 38 and a half years with absolutely no mention of what happened during that period of time. Remember that it was Nigzar on the Dor HaMidbar that they would wander in the desert for 40 years. 40 years from Yetzias Mitzrayim, so it's really 38 and a half years from there. And if you want to know what event does the Torah record that occurred during those 38 and a half years, the answer is absolutely nothing at all. Right after the mitzvah of Parah Aduma, we read about the death of Miriam in Kadesh. That is the 40th year. The Torah tells you nothing about what happened during those 38 and a half years. And in fact, the Gemara tells us that for all of those years, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not even speak to Moshe Rabbeinu. That the Jewish people were in a state of excommunication, so to speak, and they did not speak to Moshe. The Shechina did not speak to Moshe Rabbeinu, which means everything in the Torah is the first year and a half before the Chet HaMeraglim, and the last year, the 40th year, and literally nothing happens during those years. Now there is a Machlokas Rishayim. Some Rishayim put the Merida of Korach in the middle there. Many Rishayim put it next to the Meraglim, which means it still took place in the relatively close to the Meraglim, and all of those years are simply blank. Yeah.
What about all the journeys?
Well, we do have a list of journeys in Parshas Maasai, but we're not told what happened in those journeys. The journeys in Parshas Chukas that we read about yesterday are all in the 40th year. Meaning, you can figure out from Parshas Maasai where they traveled during the 38 years, but in fact, nothing that we know happened there. And in fact, Rashi points out that it was Hashem's rachamim, because if you trace in detail all the places they went in year 1 and all the places they went in year 40, there are relatively few places that they went in the middle 38 years. And Rashi says there were times that they stayed in a place for many, many years. It's not like you think every morning they were wandering around. They were staying in various places, sometimes more than 10 years. They were literally living in those places. Yeah.
Is anybody that Lame is close that during those 38 years they did not complain?
Well, that's looking at the bright side, but it could be they complained and it's not recorded. We don't really know. We don't know what happened during those 38 years. But once again, the concept is there still was the man. From the time until Miriam died in the 40th year, they had the original well of Miriam. And then in the 40th year, Moshe hit the rock and they had the replacement for the well of Miriam. And they had the Anani HaKavot until the 40th year. So the man, the Be'er and the Anani HaKavod, they did have, even though there was no Shekhinah that spoke directly with Moshe. Now, the most famous part of the Parsha is, of course, Parah Aduma, and maybe we'll talk about Parah Aduma, but interestingly enough, the Haftarah has no connection at all to Parah Aduma. The Haftarah is connected to events that took place in the 40th year after the death of Miriam and Aaron. And in particular, the Torah itself is explaining a very interesting geographical point, and that is, we know that the Jewish people crossed the Yarden from the east. Right? Aver LeYarden, they're the east, and they cross over to the west. The problem is, they're coming from Egypt, which is southwest of Eretz Yisrael. So quite logically, if you're coming from Egypt, why would you have to go south of the Dead Sea and then wind up east of the Jordan River, right? Why would that be where you would be? You should basically stay west of the Dead Sea and go up. And the answer the Torah gives is that the lands that were south and east of Eretz Yisrael were the three nations of Edom, Esav, Moab, and Ammon. And the way Rashi describes it is, Esav is to the south of the Dead Sea, right, so the Jewish people would have to go through Esav's land, Edom, to get to Eretz Yisrael. And Ammon and Moab, first Moab and Ammon, right? Moab is directly north of Esav, east of the Dead Sea, and then Ammon is north of that. So basically, the reason why the Jewish people wind up east of the Jordan is because they were not given permission to traverse the southern land of Esav, nor could they go through Moab, which would have gotten them closer, nor could they even go through Ammon. They had to keep on going north until they were able to cross. Now, the reason why HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not allow them, right? They asked Edom for Rishus. Edom did not give them permission. And Edom even threatened war. But the Jewish people did not fight Edom. And the Torah doesn't say why. The Torah does not say why. But in the book of Devarim, Moshe adds a detail that HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised the area called Mount Seir to Esav as part of his promise to Avraham Avinu. And therefore, the Jewish people were not permitted to take over that land. Now, what's interesting is the following. For reasons that are not really clear, and the Mefarshim don't make it clear, there are details in Parshas Devarim that do not appear in Parshas Chukas. Meaning, Parshas Chukas is when the events actually happen. Parshas Devarim was when Moshe Rabbeinu is recounting the events. And he adds details in Parshas Devarim that do not appear in Parshas Chukas. By that I mean the following. In Parshas Chukas, the only nation that we asked to cross through was Edom. And Edom said no, and then we kept on going till we hit Sichon, which I'll get to. But in Parshas Devarim, we discover that there were two additional requests. One was to go through the land of Moab to the north, and the other was to go through the land of Ammon. And those requests were refused as well. And in the book of Devarim, in Parshas Devarim, we are given the reason, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised the lands of Ammon and Moab to the children of Lot. Ammon and Moab are the children of Lot. Right? Remember, Lot had incest with his two daughters after the chait of Sodom. The daughters were mechavanos l'shem shemayim because they thought there were no other people. They see the whole world in a state of destruction. The oldest daughter called her son Moav from my father. The younger daughter called her son Ammon from my people. Not very tznias, as it were. And even though Ammon and Moav were generated out of incest, because of Avraham Avinu, they were promised lands, and the Jewish people were not allowed to wage war with the nations of Ammon and Moab. So the three nations that come from Avraham Avinu, other than the Jewish people, Esav, and then Ammon and Moab, we are not permitted to wage war with. If they didn't let us go through their land, we have to go around. Now you'll recall, interestingly enough, the Torah did say later in Parshas Ki Tsetse, that Ammonite and Moabite converts, if they're male, are not permitted to enter the Kahal Hashem. They cannot marry regular Jews because they did not give us food and water, even if we were willing to pay for them when we were going, leaving from Mitzrayim. And because of that cruelty and because of that lack of Hakaras Hatov, the Torah says Ammonite and Moabite converts are not permitted to enter Kahal Hashem. The exception is the female, which is why Rus HaMoaviyah was permitted. Now, an interesting question you might ponder is this. There were three nations that refused to give us food and water, even if we were willing to pay for them. One was Edom, Esav. One was Ammon, one was Moab. Now, when it comes to the Ammonites and the Moabites, the Torah is very harsh. On one hand, keep in mind, the Torah does say we are not allowed to wage war with them. Okay, that's very important. We are not allowed to wage war with Ammon and Moab. We are not allowed to take their territory. Absolutely. But at the same time, the Torah is merachek them because of their cruelty, because of their selfishness. That's Ammon and Moab. When it comes to Esav, we have the same rule. We are not allowed to initiate war with them or take their territory. But there is no richuk, lehepach. The Torah actually says, lo titaev
Edomi, you shall not despise the Edomites. Ki achichahu. Amazingly enough, he is your brother. Esav is your brother too. Do not hate the Esav. And this has a halakhic repercussion that says if an Edomite converts, we don't really know who Edomites are today, we don't have them today, the third generation can enter, meaning to say, it's a little complicated how you figure that out, but in the simple, I'll give you the simplest scenario. An Edomite generation one can marry another Edomite generation one. They have a generation two. A generation two can marry another generation two. And the third generation is now permitted to marry into the Jewish people. Now, the Gemara has endless discussions about what if a generation one marries a generation two, what's the status of the child? We don't have to get into all the details. But to keep it very simple, a 1-1 produces a 2 can marry a 2, produces a 3 is permitted. Same thing, by the way, is by Egyptians. The modern Egyptians are not the ancient Egyptians, but the ancient Egyptians, too, have a unique heter that if they convert, the third generation can enter. So one question you might ponder is, since the behavior of Esav, Ammon, and Moab is identical, they refuse to give us passage, and they refuse to give us water and food, even though we were willing to pay, why is the Torah so harsh, comparatively speaking, on the Ammonites and the Moabites, and the Torah fakert? The Torah has rachmanis on some level for the Bnei Esav by allowing them admission, at least in the third generation. And Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says that the issue about Ammon and Moab is not cruelty. If it's cruelty, Esav might be more cruel. But the issue is lack of hakaras hatov and gratitude. And the difference is Ammon and Moab, coming from Lot, were only and exclusively the beneficiaries of kindness from Avraham. Avram always showed them kindness. Avram always showed them care, concern. And if they refuse to give food and water to the descendants of Avram Avinu, that is not just cruelty, but it's a lack of gratitude. By Esav, it's kind of the opposite. Esav has nothing to be grateful to Yaakov about, at least in a simple level. Esav, in some sense, was victimized. Now, victimized for good reasons. Esav got tricked into giving up the Bechorah. Esav got tricked into giving up the brachos. Now, good, we're not going to talk about that parsha. You know, we have to assume that was the cheshbon, that's what God wanted, that the brachos had to go to Yaakov. But nevertheless, from a human perspective, Esav's hatred has at least an apparent justification. So yes, Esav is cruel. Esav is vindictive. But you don't have the pagam of a lack of hakaras hatov, because Esav has nothing to have hakaras hatov for. So you see from here that hakaras hatov is such an essential component of what it means to be Jewish that nations that don't have hakaras hatov are permanently excluded from Am Yisrael, at least mitzad the Zecharim, even though Esav is not, and by the way, the Rambam writes, even Amalek is not. Amazingly enough, the Shitas HaRambam is, an Amaleki can convert to Judaism, and you wouldn't kill him. Meaning, even Amalek, where we're supposed to destroy because they're evil, if they want to become part of Klal Yisrael with sincerity, we embrace them. Ammon and Moab, on one hand, we don't hurt them. Right? The Torah commands us not to hurt them, but they can't be Yidden. They can't be regular Yidden. So this is something to think about when we talk about what is the midah that is so fundamental to being a Jew, is hakaras hatov. I think I mentioned a number of times, I'll repeat it again, the Sfas Emes's beautiful thought of why Jews are called Yehudim. And he says, because Leah called her fourth son Yehuda, because she said, Hapam Oda Es Hashem, I am now grateful to God, Hoda'ah. And Rashi explains, because she saw with Ruach HaKadosh there would be 12 tribes, 12 boys, 12 Shvatim. And she knows there are four wives, Rachel, Leah, Bilhah, Zilpah. Each wife is entitled to 3. 12 divided by 4 is 3. So for the first 3, she's not grateful because it's coming to her. But when she has number 4, Natalti Yeser Al Chelki, I have taken more than I deserve. That equals gratitude. Gratitude is the feeling, Hashem has given me more than I deserve. Says the Sfas Emes, Jews are called Yehudim because every Jew must go through life with the feeling, Hashem has given me more than I deserve. And let me just remind you, the Sfas Emes said this in the context of a rapidly anti-Semitic culture where Jews were living in poverty. Almost 100% of the Jews were in dire poverty with no opportunity to economically better themselves. And the Sfas Emes told his Hasidim in Ger, one has to always feel Hashem has given me more than I deserve. And how much more so, Baruch Hashem, in our society, which is certainly much more comfortable than the society that he was talking about. And this is what you see from Amon and Mayav, the Yesaid of Akara Satayv. So you understand, again, that when the Torah says we condemn Amon and Mayav because they did not give us food and water, that's what it says in Kiseitse, it isn't merely the cruelty, because if that would have been the case, that would have been the identical issue with Esav, where the Torah says, Lo titaev adomi, do not despise the Edomite, because he is your brother, which, by the way, is a remarkable sentence anyway. You know, don't hate Esav because he's also your brother. That's a pretty amazing statement to make. But be it as it may, the issue is not cruelty. The issue is a lack of Hakaras HaTov. And if one does not have Hakaras HaTov, there is something deficient, something missing. One cannot enter Klal Yisrael with that midah. In fact, that might even be why in the Ten Commandments, in the Aseres HaDibrais, right, everyone knows the first five are supposed to be Bein Adam LaMakom, between man and God. The second five are Bein Adam LaChaveiro, between man and man. But people ask the question that the fifth commandment on the first column is Kibud Avayim, honoring your parents. And people ask the question, well, honoring your parents is Bein Adam LaChaveiro, between human beings. Why is it in the first five? So one answer might be, well, otherwise you have four and six, but okay, because you know we could have adjusted it one way or the other. But one of the simple answers is that the yesod of kibud avayim is hakaras hatov, gratitude. And even if one's parents, one might feel, did not do the best job in the world, but the one thing that they gave you was life, and life is the foundation of everything else that you can accomplish. Any mitzvahs that you can do, you can only do because you're alive. And if one has hakaras hatov to one who gave them life, then one can feel hakaras hatov to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the ultimate source of life. If one does not have the hakaras hatov to those who gave you life, then one cannot have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yes, sir?
About
Brightwoods.
Now, the people in the Far East, people from India, the people from Japan and China, were never anti-Semitic, and the Torah makes no restriction against Gerim from those lands. So, it's worth looking at the aspect that there never was any anti-Semitism from those that were.
Right. Well, you know, again, I think that confirms the pointer, meaning to say, normally the doors of conversion are open to anybody who sincerely wants to become a Jew. We don't proselytize, but if they want to become a Jew, they become a Jew, and they're welcome, and we cherish them and the like. The Torah excludes only very, very small numbers of categories of people that have destructive and immoral tendencies that could undermine the Jewish people. And you're correct, when those tendencies don't exist, even if it's neutral, so to speak, they neither love Jews nor hate Jews, we will allow them to come in, no question. So you're correct, there's very good reason why we don't have any discrimination, so to speak, against those from the East. Now, I want to continue the geography lesson a little bit, though, because the Haftarah is a lot about geography, surprisingly enough, although there's some interesting stories there which are not connected to the Parsha, but which raise really, really big problems, like Yiftach's daughter, which I'll get to briefly. But basically the following. So the Jewish people are coming from the south. They're coming from Egypt. And when they hit the area south of the Dead Sea and they would just like to make a tour north, they can't do so because south of the Dead Sea is the land of Esav. And Esav doesn't let them go through, and they're not allowed to wage war. So they have to keep on going east, and then they turn north and go north of Esav's land. And once again, they want to go to the west and go through. They can't do that because of Moab, etc., and the like. But at some point, they keep on going, and they go past the Nahal Arnon. The Wadi, Nahal actually means a Wadi, it's kind of the Wadi of Arnon. And if you look at a map, you know, we know where Nahal Arnon is. It's basically a stream that comes out of the middle of the Dead Sea. And the one who owns that section of land between the river, or between the Wadi of Arnon and Yabok, which is a little further north, is Sihon, a king of the Amori, one of the seven nations of Canaan. And here, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us the green light to wage war. And we conquer the land of Sihon between the Nahal of Arnon and the Nahal of Yabok. Okay, Arnon and Yabok. Because Arnon is to the south, Yabok is to the north. That is the land of Sihon Melech Emori. And that, as you know, was given to Reuven and Gad. Eventually, and then we went to Og Melech HaBashan, which is around the Golan, and that was given to the Chatzi Shevet Menashe and the like. Now, why were we allowed to conquer the land of Sichon, and we were not allowed to conquer the land of Edom, Moab, and Ammon? Because Edom was given his Yerusha by Hashem as a descendant, a son of Yitzchak. And Ammon and Moab were given their Yerusha as descendants or relatives of Avraham. But the Amori were given no rights by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore they attacked us. We were permitted to conquer their lands, and that became the land of Eber HaYarden. Now, what's interesting is, however, the Torah records a fascinating little fact, and that is Sihon Melech HaAmori himself had conquered that land from Moab. Originally, Moabite territory went north of Arnon all the way to Yabok. Sihon conquered the land from Arnon to Yabok, leaving the Moabites with the territory south of Arnon. So the problem basically was Sihon's land was Moabite territory. So that is actually the Rekha for the historical discussion in the Haftarah of Yiftach, where all of a sudden the Ammonite king, first of all, it's a strange thing, it was never Ammonite territory, which is pretty interesting. He's trying to slip, the Ammonite king in the time of Yiftach is trying to do a fast one anyway, because he's kind of saying, well, this belonged to Moab, and you know, we're Moab's brothers, therefore it belongs to, I mean, the truth is, it never belonged to him, his nation anyway. But he's making the argument, the Jews have to give back Eber HaYarden, because it once belonged to Moab, and you don't have the right to take Moabite territory. Ignoring a little bit that he's Ammon and not Moab, but okay. And the halachic answer is, the Gemara has a very, very catchy phrase, and that is, Ammon u'Moab tiharu b'Sichon. The lands of Ammon or Moab became purified through the conquest of Sichon. Meaning, the Torah prohibits taking the land of Ammon and Moab. But if that land of Ammon and Moab is taken by another nation, it is no longer the land of Ammon and Moab, it's the land of Sichon. Therefore, the Jews are allowed to take it. Now, this is an interesting construct, by the way. This actually recognizes, and this needs to be defined, that halacha recognizes the legal acquisition of ownership by military conquest. Because essentially what it's saying is, Sichon's conquest of the land of Moab no longer made it Moabite territory. It became Amorite territory. And since the halacha only prohibited the conquest of Moabite or Ammonite territory, Amon and Moab became kosher b'sichot. And that's actually Yiftach's argument. Yiftach articulates that argument by basically saying, hey, we took it from Sichon, we didn't take it from Moab, therefore we have the right to this land. By the way, this idea of Amon and Moab tieru b'sichot is actually the basis of explicating a difficulty in Megillas Esther. If you remember in Megillas Esther, after Haman was hung, so the pasuk says that Achashverosh gave Mordechai and Esther base Haman. He gave Mordechai and Esther the house and the possessions of Haman. Now we have a problem. Chazal have a tradition that Haman is from Amalek. They get that because Haman ha'agagi, which might be obscure, is translated as Haman who is descended from Agag, and Agag was the king of Amalek that Shaul was supposed to kill, and when Shaul didn't kill him, Agag briefly escaped and impregnated somebody, and when Shmuel killed Agag, that woman was still pregnant, and eventually the child was the ancestor of Haman. So that's Haman ha'agagi. Now, we know that the mitzvah of destroying Amalek is not only to destroy the people of Amalek, but to destroy the possessions, the animals, the shor v'chamor, to destroy all of the property of Amalek. In fact, the Mefarshim say, that's why the Megillah says, when the Jews fought against their enemies, it says many times, ubabiza lo shalchu et yadam, they did not take the spoils of their enemies, because their enemies were Amalekim, and they weren't allowed to take the spoils. Again, some learn a different pshat, that they didn't want to think that the Jews were doing it just to steal. Okay, but others learn halachically they couldn't take the spoils because it was Amalek. So the question becomes, how does Mordechai and Esther take over Haman's house? Haman's house is the shalal of Amalek. You're not allowed to do that. So one of the answers that the Mefarshim give is the following. There is a halacha that if somebody is executed because they committed sins, like say by a Beis Din, their property is not forfeited and it goes to their Yorshim, right? Just because somebody died because they were Mechalel Shabbos, their heirs still inherit their property. But there is another halacha that says that if somebody is killed because of treason committed against the king, that's called Moreid B'Malchus, their property is forfeited to the king and their heirs don't get it. Now Haman was technically killed because he was considered to be a Moreid Malchus, because after all, he wanted to kill the queen, right? He was planning on killing the queen who happened to be Jewish, even though he didn't know that she was Jewish at the time. So as a result, all of Haman's property, the title to all of Haman's property, vested in Achashverosh. So when Achashverosh gave it to Esther and Mordechai, he was not giving them Amaleki property. He was giving them property that he already acquired from an Amalek. And the same way that we say Amon and Moab became purified in the conquest of Sichon, so too the property of Amalek, and I know this may sound like money laundering, but indeed the principle would be that the Amaleki property became koshered, as it were, by Achashverosh acquiring ownership based on the principle that those who are killed because they're Moreid B'Malchus, their property goes to the king. And that's why the pasuk is very meduyak by saying, Achashverosh gave the house of Haman to Mordechai and Esther. In other words, it was Achashverosh's property by virtue of the Haruge Malchus, Nichseim Lemelech, those who rebel against the king, their property goes to the king. Right? But certainly that is the absolute, by the way, in other words, Yesh L'chalek, by the way, in other words, the to compare the principle of Amon and Moav Tiru B'Sichon and apply it to Amalek is not entirely clear. One might still say if it comes from Amalek, it's tainted. In other words, Bishlama, when it comes to Amon and Moav, one could make the argument the Torah does not want us to deprive Amon and Moav of their land. If they've already been deprived of their land, we're not doing anything. Masha'en Kein Amalek is a different thing. The property of Amalek is spiritually tainted. One might argue that transfer to Achashverosh doesn't really help. You still have that. But nevertheless, Achronim do want to give this as an answer. And this is essentially this idea of Amon and Mayav got kashered in Sichon is what Yiftach responds to when Amon basically says, give it back. This is Moabite territory. You're not allowed to have it. And his point was, hey, we've had it for 300 years. And he actually adds somewhat sarcastically, whatever your God gives you, you get to keep. Whatever our God gives you, we get to keep. He says, Kamosh. Kamosh is the God of Moab. What Kamosh gives you will be yours. What Hashem gives us is ours. Okay, that's a fair deal. Okay. Now, to go back a little bit, so that's the connection to the connection to the Haftarah is that the Chumash describes our ability to conquer the land of Sichon, and Yiftach describes how that was a controversy that emerged more than 300 years later when the Ammonites claimed that we had no right to that land, and Yiftach goes over the history of Amon and Mayav Tiru B'Sichon. But the beginning of the Haftarah starts off with some of the background and history of Yiftach as a Shofet. Oh yes, by the way, I want to go back a little bit. I'm sorry for being out of order here. When I mentioned, because I wanted to share something with you from Chaim Shmulevitz, I mentioned to you the issue that Amon and Mayav are rejected not because of their cruelty, but they are rejected because of their lack of Hakara Satov. And of course, keep in mind, in next week's Parsha, not only did they deny us food and water, but they also hire Bilam to curse us, right? That's a continuation of next week's Parsha. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz said, as opposed to Esav is a victim of some legitimate grievances, or at least something that might seem like a legitimate grievance, and therefore Esav cannot be condemned. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz even applied this to Amalek. He said the following. Amalek is a grandson of Esav. And what's Amalek's parentage? Amalek had a son, Eliphaz. Eliphaz had a concubine, not a regular wife, a mistress, whose name was Timnah. And Timnah lived with Eliphaz, gave birth to Amalek. Now, Rashi brings a medrash that says, Timnah was actually from the Egyptian royal household, like Hagar was. And Timnah wanted to be misdabek in the family of Avraham, to go under Tachas Kanfei Ashchina. But for some reason she was rejected, she was thought not to be fitting. So she basically said, if I cannot connect to the holy part of this family, I will connect to the other part of the family. But her kavana on some level was a desire to be connected to the children of Avraham. And out of this union came Amalek. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz used to say, from here we see the tremendously awesome negative power of rejection. Amalek was born out of the painful rejection of his mother as not being worthy. And Rav Chaim used to apply this very practically. He had, sometimes the other Rashi Yeshiva were a little upset with him. He never believed, of course, Mir was much smaller in those days. In Rav Chaim Shmulevitz's time, Mir was under 1,000 students. Now it's like seven times more. But Rav Chaim was almost fanatic about never kicking anybody out of the yeshiva, no matter what they did. He says, keep them in unless they're an active, destructive influence on other people. Even if they're doing nothing, let them hang around. And his attitude was, his hashkafa was, and he would always bring this up, because when you reject people, you're producing Amaleks in the world. People cannot be stigmatized. They cannot be rejected. They need to feel that they're worthwhile, that they're worthy, that they have a place. And he would often say this. He would often say that rejection was the sherish of Amalek. Now, the truth of the matter is, we have to be careful here, because one could even look at Hitler and say, you know, Hitler went through different, you know, rejections, etc. This does not excuse people. Amalek is not given a pass because they came from rejection. We're supposed to kill Amalek. We recognize it as evil, and we have to eradicate it. So this does not mean, you know, someone had a troubled past, therefore they can, you know, murder people and, you know, there's no consequences. Certainly, wrongdoers are accountable for the choices that they make, because after all, many people are abused and they turn out to be righteous, tzaddikim, good people. That's Bechira. God does not take away the capacity of choice. Nevertheless, Rav Chaim says that when, from our perspective, when we reject and disparage, we can often produce a lot of, indirectly produce a lot of evil in the world. And he says that was Amalek, and that's why he says he was very, very makbid not to expel people from Yeshiva. Yeah.
Nibbled away at me. A lesson to be learned. When Hashem said to Chokat Sefer Amalek, that whole pasuk is very detailed. Don't leave one vestige.
Right, right.
He delineates, don't leave anything.
Yeah.
And we didn't listen. And all these little vestiges of mm-hmm. That's what we're suffering from
well,
through the ages.
Well, that's right.
It's a lesson. Yeah. Like when Moshe, when Hashem said, speak to the rock and get water, Moshe right. went a step further and hit the rock.
Right.
Except we didn't get impaired.
Right, that's right, that's right.
You have to listen 100%.
That's correct. Little things matter. Well, the analogy is cancer. You can't kind of say, well, we just left a little bit of cancer in the person, you know.
Yeah.
We got most of it. You know, it doesn't, unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. That's very true. In fact, this was even, Lahavdil, this was... Mayor Giuliani's philosophy, why New York has a relatively lower crime rate. For many, many years, the New York City Police Department was only concerned with big things. They said there were so many murders, so many rapes here. You know, we're not going to worry about graffiti or people or squeegee people or whatever it is. But as a result, you know, crime kept on going up anyway. He had a shita that you have to start with eradicating even small things because then you create a certain atmosphere of conscientiousness and law-abiding, and that affects everything else. So little things, you know, do make, I mean, there's really nothing little, but things that look little are actually very, very significant. But this was Rav Chaim's word. In fact, they tell a story about the Chafetz Chaim, a beautiful story about, they tell two stories, and I'm not sure if it's the same person or a different person, because there are two stories about a Bachar in Radin that was Mechalel Shabbos. And I'm not sure if it's the same students. Story number one is the Chafetz Chaim expelled him from the yeshiva because he was a Mechalel Shabbos and it was a bad influence. And as the Bacher was walking away, the Chafetz Chaim says, "Where are you going?" And he says, "Well, the yeshiva kicked me out of the yeshiva." He says, "No, I kicked you out of the yeshiva because you're a bad influence, but I still care about you, so you'll stay in my house. And we'll learn together." Now, I'm not sure if the boy liked that, because with the Chafetz Chaim you couldn't come late or anything like that. But that's a perfect, such a perfect example of the notion that on one hand you have to worry about all of your talmidim, but at the other hand, not at the expense of even this one. You still care about this one. So that's story number one. They tell another story. I'm not sure if it's the same guy, in which he went out. Chafetz Chaim met him privately. When the person went out, and he was totally shaken, and he changed his life, and he became frum. And someone asked him, what happened there? And he says, the Chafetz Chaim just took my hand in his two hands, and he looked at me with his big, blue, piercing eyes, and tears came out of his eyes, and they fell on my hand, and they felt like burning acid on my hands. And he just looked at me and said, Shabbos, Shabbos. And he says that I saw in those eyes the love that he had for me and the inexpressible pain that he had that I was not keeping Shabbos. And I said I could never cause him to feel that way again. He says, I couldn't, and that changed my life. The story goes, now I've heard this, a lot of people claim credit for this story. I think Rav Shia Tversky, Rav Shlomo Riskin, but at one time Rabbi Riskin was telling this story about how 5 seconds with the Chafetz Chaim changed this man's life, and Rav Riskin said at the end, I just wish I knew what the Chafetz Chaim said, and then an old man gets up from the audience. This has never happened to me. I don't know why. Some rabbis kind of have this mazel. I don't know. Says, an old man gets up from the audience and says, Ani ha'ish, ani ha'gever, I am the man. And he recounted that the Chafetz Chaim held his hands and said, Shabbos. And that changed him. So, it's important. I think this is an issue that even families face. I mean, unfortunately. I mean, sometimes a person has a child that, in some extreme cases, might be off the derech, might not be keeping mitzvahs properly. And there's a fear that of a negative effect on the whole family. And I'm not giving anyone a particular etzah, but you see from the Chafetz Chaim that on one hand, you must protect your family. On the other hand, you have to try to do so in a way that this child is still loved and not rejected. And it's very difficult to figure out how to do one without the other. I'm sorry, how to do one and do the other as well. But that's the lesson of the story, that somehow the needs of the klal do not sacrifice the needs of the yachid. You have to kind of try to do both at the same time. Very, 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 very difficult. But this is what the story teaches us. Now, to go back to the beginning of the Haftarah, though, right? So again, as I say, the only reason why this is the Haftarah of Chukas is because it does give us some of the historical background of the land of Sichon, Amun and Mayav Tiru b'Sichon, and this was the diplomatic argument that Yiftach made. But the Haftarah begins that Yiftach himself was a kid at risk, who had a fairly troubled background. Yiftach was the son of a man, Gilad. He lived east of the Yarden. And it says his mother is described as being an Isha Zaina, as being the wife of a Zaina. Now, once again, remember by Rachav, I had mentioned by Rachav HaZaina, we had a machlokas. Does zona mean prostitute, or does zona mean innkeeper? But here, it certainly means prostitute, although I'll give you an alternative shot, because innkeeper is not relevant. In other words, in Rachav, it might mean an innkeeper, because that's why they went to her, because she had an inn. Here, there'd be no reason to mention what her job was. I mean, you know, the Torah never says, and he married an accountant. You know, it doesn't say, you know. So, presumably the issue is Isha Zona. She was a prostitute. However, Chazal say, even with that translation, we can moderate it quite a bit. Because they basically say that prostitute just means she was a woman from another tribe. And this goes back to the end of Bamidbar, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu said that if a woman inherits property from her father's tribe, she's not allowed to marry somebody outside of her tribe, because that's going to result in the inheritance of her tribe going to another Shevet. So she's called a Zona, not because Chas V'Shalom she was actually involved in Zanus, but the word Zona literally means a woman who turns away. In other words, she turned away from who she rightfully should have married. And she married a man from another tribe. So Chazal do moderate it quite a bit. Of course, keep in mind that al pi halacha, there was no issue to do this. Because Chazal teach us that the prohibition of marrying outside of the tribe only applied for the very first generation. This is more than 300 years. In fact, one of the reasons of the 15th of Av is a day of Simcha, is that at some point after Yoshua, people were permitted to marry all the tribes. So there was no Isser in it. But apparently, Chazal say, there was still a minhag, that women were supposed to marry within their tribes. So at worst, this Ben Isha Zona, all she did was she violated a minhag. First of all, why is she the violator? You could say that her husband's the violator. You know, I mean, she's no worse than her husband. I mean, it required both people. But that's how Chazal understand Isha Zona. But be it as the case may be, Yiftach was treated as an illegitimate child. Of course, the truth of the matter is, this is also perplexing the way Chazal understand it. Because if anything, the fact that Gilad married a woman outside of his tribe will actually increase the Yerusha of the brothers. Because what happens is the following. She brings in property from her tribe. Now, when she dies, if her husband's still alive, it'll go to her husband. When her husband dies, it'll go to her children. So if anything, or his children, if anything, Gilad's children are going to be enriched by this extra inheritance. But it does mention that they regarded him as kind of illegitimate. And he was rejected, and he ran away. And he lived in a land called Tov. Now that's a strange land, right? There's no land that's known as Tov. According to one medrash, Tov just means Chutz La'aretz. Wow, that's a little, the land of plenty. Why is it called Tov? So the medrash says that from a superficial, non-spiritual perspective, and maybe there's a remez here, that Yiftach was not holding in such a high level of ruchnius. Chutz La'aretz was called Tov because you don't have to give truma, miser. In other words, you keep 100%, right? The taxes are less. You keep 100% of what you make. You don't have to give anything away to anybody else. So that's called Tov. Chutz La'aretz in those days, not today so much, but Chutz La'aretz in those days was a tax haven because you didn't have to give trumos and Masros. And essentially, this Yiftach became the head of a gang who attached themselves to Yiftach. Anashim Reikim, empty people, garnished hooligans. And he used to conduct raids against the local populations. He essentially was a gang member. He was a gang leader. And what happens is they turn to the gang leader and they ask him, help us against the Ammonites that are attacking us. And Yiftach says, oh, all those years you rejected me. All those years you pushed me away. I'm not good enough for you. But now you want me to help you in war. And he makes a deal. He has he's a sharp negotiator. He says, I will help you in war if you will make me your leader. And they strangely enough agree. This is why, in many, many ways, Yiftach is considered to be the nadir, kind of the lowest, right? When Chazal make the point that no matter who your shofet is, you have to respect him, it always uses the A to Z extreme, Yiftach bedoro kishmuel bedoro. Shmuel was the greatest of the shoftim. Yiftach is considered to be the lowest of the shoftim, although undoubtedly if Hashem gave him this job, you know, he was much higher than perhaps we would think, but nevertheless, as compared to all the shoftim, he was considered to be the lowest, and you're mechuyev to listen to the lowest, just as you're mechuyev to listen to the highest. And Yiftach, as we say, did eventually win against Ammon, and nothing was conquered. And again, the issue was not conquest, the issue was simply repelling Ammon as a threat and keeping the land of Sichon for the two tribes of Reuven and Gad. Now, the best known part of this story, though, the Haftarah doesn't give you the end of it, which is, you know, it's good. The Haftarah doesn't want to get you into unnecessary controversy, but the Haftarah just talks about Yiftach's vow. Yiftach said, if Hashem will give me victory, the first thing that comes out of my house I will bring as a korban for Hashem. And the Haftarah just says, and he achieved a great victory, and it doesn't go out any further. But we all know, in the book of Shoftim, as he's coming home victorious against this enemy, his daughter comes out to greet him, betupim, with tambourines or drums, ubimecholot, and dancing. And she was the first one. And the pasuk indicates that, I'll explain what this might mean, that Yiftach carried out his vow. And it says 4 days a year, the young women would go to the mountains to cry over the daughter of Yiftach. So this is really a mind-blowing, very, very difficult type of story. First of all, the halacha, of course, is absolutely very, very clear that even if one would have made a solemn oath explicitly that I'm going to give my child as a sacrifice, that's absolutely usher, and you don't do it. Second of all, he certainly didn't have in mind that this would include his daughter, right? So it wouldn't. So halachically, there's no issue that she wouldn't be that she shouldn't have been sacrificed at all. So first of all, let me share with you the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel does have an interesting pshat. The Abarbanel says that when Yiftach said, the first person who walks out of my door, the first thing that walks out of my door, I will give as a sacrifice. If it would have been a kosher animal, it would have been sacrificed. Of course, he shouldn't have made the vow that way, Chazal say, because what if it would have been a donkey or a horse, right? There's the whole thing was no good. But what he did with his daughter is, he made her the equivalent of a nun. In other words, the concept of a person being sanctified to God would mean, in his mind, kind of a hermit, a monastery. And when it says 4 days a year, the women would cry, they would actually cry with her. And it's a little meduyak. Actually, the Abarbanel has a little bit of support here, because in the book of Shoftim, she keeps on lamenting about her basulim, about her virginity, that she will never have a chance to be married and the like. Now, if she's going to be killed, then she might be thinking about her life. The Abarbanel says, no, the issue was not that she was killed. The issue is that she would remain in her virginity. She would never have a family. She would never have a husband. So the Abarbanel makes it a little easier, but still, halachically, it still makes no sense at all, because what gives a father the authority? There is a discussion whether a father can make his son or daughter a nazir, but even that is only a son that's a katan. If she's already a gadol, he has no authority over her one way or the other. So the whole story is very, very strange. Some mafarshim actually learned that he killed her. Some mafarshim learned, like the Abarbanel, she was placed in a monastery or whatever it is, a convent of sorts, although a convent of one, and the like. And the Gemara says the following. The Gemara says at the time, the Kohen Gadol at the time was still Pinchas. Pinchas was still alive, which is a pretty long time. This is 300 years from the time they left Mitzrayim. And of course, Pinchas eventually became Eliyahu HaNavi. He morphed into a different identity. And when people saw what Yiftach was planning on doing, they said to Pinchas, "You're the Kohen Gadol, you're the Posek, you're the Gadol Ador. Go and tell him he doesn't have a vow." And Pinchas said, "Well, he should come to me to ask a Shaila. It's not for me to go to people to tell them. Kavod HaTorah says they go to me." So people went to Yiftach and they said, "Go ask Pinchas." And he says, "I'm the Shofet. I am the political leader. Pinchas should go to me." And because each person was omate on their prerogatives, this woman either lost her life or she was condemned to the monastery or whatever it might be. And you see that kavod can indeed destroy a world. So this is some of the lessons. Again, to have a real pshat, how could Yiftach behave this way, is very, very difficult. And it is regarded as a great, great chait, but it also reminds us that one has to be very, very careful of the koach hadibor, the power of speech, that words do create realities, and those realities have very, very, very severe consequences. One final point, you know, we're going to read next week that Balak is going to hire a great man of words, Bilam, the professional sorcerer, to curse the Jewish people. And Hashem turns all the curses of Bilam into blessings. By the way, some want to say that Bilam, the name Bilam, actually is a contraction of Bili'am, without a nation. Because it's interesting, we don't really know what nation Bilam belongs to. And the short answer is, Bilam is a hired hand. Meaning to say, had the Jewish people hired Bilam to curse Moab, he would have worked for the Jewish people. Kind of like the old hired hand attorney, whatever it is. Whichever side hires me is what I work for. Bilam does not have any ideological commitments one way or the other. But I just want to end. The Shem Mishmuel asks a very good kasha. And in light of what we discussed, it is a good kasha. Hashem commanded the Jewish people, do not wage war with Moab. When the Moabites didn't let us go through their land, we continued to walk northward until we crossed Nahal Arnon. And we got Sichem. Balak sees this. Balak sees that the Jewish people are circling around Moabite territory and not invading. So the question becomes, what is Balak afraid of? Balak hires Bilam because he's afraid of the Jewish people taking his land. He sees that when he said, "You're not getting any food and water," the Jewish people go northward. L'chaira, there's a direct contradiction. Well, again, we see this in Parshas Devarim. I mean, if Parshas Devarim says we circled the land of Moab, then why in Parshas Balak do we read that Balak is afraid of us and he hires Bilam? It's a very good kasha. So the Shem Mishmuel says a very, very nice thought. The Shem Mishmuel says that Balak is not afraid that the Jewish people will conquer his land because he already knows that they're going around his land. He's afraid of the Jewish people reaching Eretz Yisrael. And his goal is to stop them from coming to Eretz Yisrael. What is he so afraid of? Because in the Midbar, the Jewish people are living in a totally spiritual environment, a hermetically sealed spiritual cocoon. They have the man from heaven, they have the traveling well, they have the clouds of glory. As long as the Jews live in a pure spiritual environment, their adherence to the morality of the Torah is not a reproach to any other nation.
Any other nation can simply say, well, they can listen to Hashem because they have man, they have the clouds of glory, they have the Anani HaKavod, but we live in a real world. We live in a world of struggle. We live in a world of ambiguity. We live in a world where we have to do what we do because otherwise we could not survive. In other words, the existence of a nation serving God is not a reproach to the Umos HaOlam when that nation is just purely spiritual. But once they get to Eretz Yisrael, things are going to change. There's not going to be a man. We're going to have to plant. We're going to have an army. We're going to have a real society. We're going to have to live with the nitty-gritty problems of real life, and we will still try to do so according to the morality of the Torah. Well, at that point, the nations don't have any excuse anymore. They don't have an excuse for their immorality. They don't have an excuse for their disregard of the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach. So Balak's attitude is, I'm very happy to let the Jews stay in the desert because then they become irrelevant to regular people. But once they come to Eretz Yisrael, they're going to show us that even in Gashmias, even in the materiality of Eilam Hazah, you can have Kedusha. Now we're in trouble. Now Hashem will hold us to a higher standard. So the Shema Shmuel says that Balak was not afraid of the Jews conquering his land. He was afraid of the Jews coming to Eretz Yisrael and showing that Kedusha can exist within materialism. I think I remember when we talked about the Meraglim, that's why the Meraglim didn't want to go to Eretz Yisrael. They were afraid we would lose that Kedusha once we come in. It's reminiscent a little bit of the famous remark of Theodor Herzl when he was writing about the Jewish state. I'm not sure if it's in the book or it's just something that was said bal peh, in which he was asked about the role of the clergy in a Jewish state, and he remarked, we shall confine the clergy to its synagogues as the army will be confined to its barracks. Well, for good or for bad, both parts of that statement have not proven to be true. The army, unfortunately, has not been able to be confined to its barracks. And the clergy, again, I'm not going to express good or bad, has not been confined to the synagogue. Because once again, the message of the Torah is that it's not just for ritualistic things, but Torah does impact in how one lives one's life in an overall society. So anyway, I hope you all have a nice summer. Be'ezras Hashem, we should be zeicha to binyan beis hamikdash b'karav.
Up all right?
Not today. Thank you. I appreciate it.
I have a question that was bothering me. Was the Mishkan operable in the 38 years where we don't have any?
Yes, it was. Yes.
So the Shekhinah had to come and accept the
Korbanos. Well, they accepted the Korbanos, but there was no communication to Moshe.
Right. I just remembered the article that I emailed to you in February. Ami Magazine is printing it for this week.
Oh, very nice.
But they asked me to bring it down to a layman's level to give some scenarios. So I added those. If you want, I will email you.
Why don't you email it to me?
That way you'll know more or less what I'll be interjecting.
Okay. That'd be fine. That'd be great. Thank you.